From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
As Barack gave his acceptance speech for his humanitarian award, I stood up on my chair and shouted, "You are not a peacemaker."
Jewish activists interrupt former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak's speech at the Pierre Hotel in New York, while in Ramallah, the Israeli military destroyed every building in the Arafat compound but the one he's in. We'll go to Florida to speak with three Muslim medical students. This weekend, police there apologized for stopping them. We'll talk to the young men about their ordeal. And as people around the country mobilize for anti-World Bank and International Monetary Fund protests this weekend in Washington, we'll speak with activists from South Africa and Fiji. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Arab governments are hoping to use a UN Security Council meeting today to press for an end to the siege of Yasser Arafat's compound. But the U.S. has reportedly told them it would press to prevent the council passing any resolution or would veto it. This, according to the London Guardian, the weekend attack on the compound has destroyed all but one building where Arafat and 200 supporters remain. Palestinians flooded the streets of Ramallah and every other major town in the West Bank and Gaza Strip before dawn. Amid fears that Arafat's life is in danger, ordinary Palestinians defied army curfews and checkpoints to demonstrate their support. The face-offs turned bloody in several spots in the West Bank, with tensions running higher in Ramallah, where two Palestinians, including a radio journalist, were shot dead by soldiers. This, according to medical sources, all told at least four protesters are believed to have been killed. Israel's attack on the compound generated international outcry. Javier Solana, the European Union's foreign policy chief, called the siege deplorable. France denounced it as unacceptable. And in London, the Foreign Office said it was not the right way to end terrorism. Russia also called for Israel to end its destruction of the compound. The White House said Sunday the siege is not helpful in ending terrorist violence or promoting Palestinian political reforms. Following two suicide bombings in Israel in 24 hours, the Israeli government unanimously decided to isolate Arafat in his headquarters and demand the extradition of 20 loyalists they accuse of terrorist activities. The New York Times reported today that elite special operations troops have been told to separate from the military temporarily and to join CIA units. These troops would bring their counterterrorism skills to covert missions in Iraq while allowing the Pentagon to maintain that no uniform combat forces were in action. Military officials told the Times no American military forces were operating yet in southern or western Iraq, but declined to comment on whether the CIA is already undertaking missions there. The officer who commanded the British 7th Armored Brigade in the Gulf War has announced his absolute opposition to a war in Iraq. Major General Patrick Cordingley, who commanded the renowned Desert Rats, told the London Telegraph, "There is no justification for sending British troops to Iraq." He predicted the British and U.S. forces would suffer nearly 40,000 casualties if the nation sent in 250,000 troops and a full-scale conflict broke out. According to the Telegraph, Cordingley is the first retired senior British Army officer and Gulf War vet to condemn the British government's stance on a possible Iraq war. Here in the United States, West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd has accused President Bush of planning to invade Iraq to distract public attention from growing problems at home. Byrd warned of another Gulf of Tonkin resolution passed on August 7, 1964. That resolution handed President Lyndon Johnson broad powers to escalate the war in Vietnam, a conflict that cost more than 58,000 American lives and more than 2 million Vietnamese lives. Bird told the Charleston Gazette his belief in the Constitution would prevent him from voting for Bush's war resolution. He said, quote, I am finding that the Constitution is irrelevant to the people of this administration. The West Virginia Democrat went on to say the proposed resolution Bush sent to Congress on Thursday would be the broadest possible grant of war powers to any president in the history of our republic. He said the resolution is a direct insult and an affront to the powers given to Congress. And as Democrats in Congress are concerned that passing a war resolution before they go out to campaign for the midterm elections will put the issue of patriotism above pocketbook, there is more news of the corporate crime wave. Nearly $1.4 billion in asset sales Enron recorded in recent years were little more than thinly disguised loans. This, according to a report issued Saturday by an independent bankruptcy examiner. According to the Houston Chronicle, the little-known deals, which used a twisting maze of swaps, transfers, and hedges, inflated Enron's bottom line between 1997 and late 2001 and contributed to the energy company's meteoric rise. The six transactions outlined in the report also raised substantial questions about the role large investment banks played in financing the transactions. Several banks mentioned in the report include J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, ABN AMRO, among Enron's largest creditors in the company's bankruptcy proceedings. And here in New York, over the weekend, former New York police officer Charles Schwarz was sentenced to 5 years in prison for committing perjury during the Abner Louima trial. The pretrial agreement leaves unresolved one of the largest questions in the police brutality case: who was the second officer who joined Officer Justin Volpe in the beating? In August 97, Louima was brutally beaten in a Brooklyn precinct station bathroom. Officers sodomized him with a broomstick. He almost died from his injuries. The sentencing agreement includes no admission that Schwarz was the officer who restrained Louima, but it also prohibits Schwarz from continuing to proclaim his innocence publicly. Prosecutors, a former police officer who lied about the torture of a Haitian immigrant in the precinct bathroom, was sentenced to 5 years in prison, the maximum penalty for perjury. With plea bargains, none of the parties get what they want, but it puts an end to it. So said Louima's attorney, Sanford Rubenstein. He said, it seems to me enough is enough. But Abner Louima, talking after the plea deal was finalized, said, this is not the way I wanted it to end. Graphic Light, John Coltrane. He would have been 76 years old if he was alive today. You are listening to Democracy Now! As the Israeli military destroys every building in the Arafat compound but one, the one Yasser Arafat is in New York, Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, gave a speech at the Pierre Hotel. Jewish activists interrupted that speech. We're joined in our studio right now by one of those activists. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you tell us what it is that you did?
Well, yes. At the Pierre last night, Barak was receiving a humanitarian award. And as he began his speech, activist Steve Quester, another New York-based Jew, stood up on his chair and held a banner over his head, which read, "Jews for a Free Palestine." And he shouted and interrupted the speech, and the entire crowd turned and looked at him as he said, "You are not a peacemaker." He then gave a lot of information to back his claim up as he shouted, "Barak is the biggest settlement builder since Shamir. Barak ordered Palestinian land confiscated and settlements expanded. Barak ordered the IDF to open fire on unarmed worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque," which is, of course, what really incited the Intifada, "and that he has the blood on his hands of 100 Palestinian children who were killed and 4,000 injured before any suicide bombing."
So he said this.
Yes, he stood on his chair holding the banner and said all of this as security guards rushed to grab him and drag him out. And he continued shouting, and people were listening to some extent, although also very frustrated as he was dragged out. And then things sort of calmed down again, and Barak continued speaking. About 10 minutes later, as Barak was discussing the role of Jewish history in our lives as Jews, he said, "As Jews, we need to think about our history of oppression. As Jews, we always need to, you know, be conscious of where we come from through the Holocaust, through the diaspora." And at that moment, I stood up on my chair, much to everybody's surprise, and I said, "As a Jew, as a Jewish woman, I'm called to speak for justice. And I'm here to tell you that you are not a peacemaker, and that I have to fight for justice, and there will be no justice and no peace until the brutal Israeli occupation ends." So I continued to shout these things. You know, "I'm here to fight for justice and the occupation must end. As a Jew, I believe this. I have this conviction because I'm a Jew." And they dragged me out and continued shouting as I was pulled away. Both Steve and I had audience members claw at us or punch us or grab us as we were being dragged out by security. And they threw us on the ground outside and frisked us and put us against the wall. But fortunately, we weren't arrested in the end, and I think we got our point across.
How did the other members of the group who were awarding Barak respond to you, the Jewish participants in this?
There was definitely a mix. Clearly, our role is to represent the Jewish opposition to the occupation, which is a large movement, despite the media representation of us as a monolith. So there were definitely people in the audience who were receptive and who we heard as they walked by saying, you know, "I would be proud of my children if they took on this kind of intensity and this kind of, you know, oppositional stance." And then, of course, there were people who were very angry who attacked us on our way out.
Louisa Solomon, you're now going off to class.
You go to the new school.
You were in the occupied territories this summer.
Yes, I was working with the International Solidarity Movement in Nablus during the invasion in August.
And as you listen to the latest reports of the mass protests in the occupied territories and the destruction of Arafat's compound, your comments?
Well, it's very disturbing being back. I want so badly to be there to be helping with the organizing that I know Palestinians are doing. They have amazing organizational skills and have an amazing nonviolent resistance movement. And I can't wait to go back and continue to help them in whatever way I can.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Louisa Solomon is with an ad hoc group of Jewish activists who went to the Pierre Hotel last night and were detained by police as they stood up and protested the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak giving a speech. Was Clinton there?
Clinton was not there, but he was beamed in on a gigantic screen in the corner to send his regards to his good friend Barak.
Louisa Solomon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, on September 13th, Eamon Gaith, Cambiz Butt, and Omer Chowdhury were driving through Georgia to Florida, where they were scheduled to begin a six-week clinical training course at Larkin Community Hospital in Miami. They're all three Muslim medical students. But after stopping in a diner in Georgia, a woman reported to local police that the men were joking about 911. She said that one of the students allegedly said they mourned on 911 and they're going to mourn again on 913. In the ensuing hours, Florida officials unleashed a massive manhunt, which was televised across the country. 20 miles of Alligator Alley were shut down. The cars of the young men were searched. A bomb squad blew up a backpack of one of the young medical students. All three were detained for 17 hours, denied any wrongdoing, and were released by police without charges. After the incident, Larkin Community Hospital decided not to host the students, and officials said it received hundreds of threatening emails. Now, authorities in Florida are saying that they made a mistake in arresting the three young Muslim men last week on suspicion of planning an attack. We're going to go right now to the three students. I talked to them just before the Florida officials apologized and asked them about their overall ordeal. We began with Eamon Gaith.
Well, I guess I could start with the incident at Shoney's. We walked in Thursday, and we sat down. We ate our it was like a late breakfast, and then we got up and we left. A while later, around 11 o'clock, 11:30, near Florida, we got pulled over after leaving the toll booth, and we were placed in a squad car, handcuffed for approximately 17 hours, and then we were let go.
What did they say? Why did they stop you?
Well, initially we didn't get any reports of why we were stopped. Well, they said well, it's because you blew a toll. You didn't pay the toll. And that is the reason that we were pulled over. And an hour before we were let go, they had informed us that somebody had called in a threat that we had said something or claimed something, and this is why all of this was happening.
So you were arrested. How long were you held?
Well, I mean, they
or
never
you were
placed
detained.
Us, yeah, they never placed us under arrest. We were held from 11:30 at night. We were handcuffed, hands behind your back and everything, in a squad car until about 8 or 9 in the morning. And then we were transported to vans until about 5 o'clock in p.m.
And then you were released?
Yeah, then we were released after that.
And what happened after that? How is it that you ended up losing your internships at Larkin Community Hospital?
Well, when they let us go, we had no idea what was. I mean, the extent. Even my friends were they were saying we should call our families. And Umar actually said to Kambiz, you know, don't tell them what happened to us right now. It might worry them. Little did we know, you know, we were plastered all over media everywhere, so everybody knew already. But
everyone knew while you were still being detained.
Yeah. Well, we were in the vans. We didn't know what was going on. You know, the whole world knew. Camera crews were everywhere.
Well, let's bring Omar Chowdhury into the conversation. What did you do then after you were released and you realized that you were everywhere?
Well, we were, when we got out, first thing we did is we got in the cars and we went to the nearest restroom because we all had to go. But as soon as we got there, the press was everywhere, and when they started asking us questions, we realized that everyone already knew who we were, and everyone knew that we were detained for 17 hours. And then we just had the press to deal with and our reputations.
Let me ask Kambiz Butt, what did you understand the woman in the restaurant who said she overheard you say?
Well, once we got a chance to actually watch the media coverage, we heard her saying that we were saying things about 9/11 and 9/13, which is funny because, you know, we never even mentioned those things. She also heard us speaking in Arabic, all three of us, and that's also pretty ironic because only Eamon can speak Arabic. Me and Omar don't speak it or understand it. And she talked about us bringing things down, which was in reference to Umber bringing a car from Kansas City to Miami.
What do you mean when she said, you mean she quoted you saying you're going to bring something down?
Well, she said that she overheard us saying that, I guess I asked Umber, do you have enough to bring it down? and something of that nature. And what that was in reference to was I was asking Umar, you know, do you have enough money to ship your car down from Kansas City to Miami? And Umar's like, well, if I don't, then I'll have, you know, I have some connections which can arrange that to occur. You know, this is only in reference to him bringing his car from Kansas City to Miami. So she just took tidbits of our conversation, put them together, and came up with a story based solely on our physical appearance.
Hmm. So, Eamon Gaith, after you realized that this story was out everywhere and everyone knew who you were, what did the three of you do?
Well, we were primarily concerned. The thing that hurt the most was after we left and we found out, you know, what was going on, and everybody, it was a blanket debate. Everybody had accepted the fact that we had said such things. And that really, you know, hurt deeply. Nobody even considered, I mean, the debate wasn't whether or not we said it. The debate was, well, did they say it meaning it, or did they say it as a joke? And which hurts deeply. I mean, nobody questioned whether or not we said it, you know? And it brings about another point. I mean, this lady, we have no animosity against her at all. May God forgive her. But what if it was somebody else that had malice in their heart and had put something in our car and then called? What would have happened to us then, you know?
So what did happen? How did the hospital end up saying that you could not begin your internships there?
Well, they received a lot of hate mail and threats, actually. And we urged the FBI to look into that because nobody should be governed. Nobody's policy should be governed by fear. So we hope that the FBI does speedily look into this as they had done in our case, you know. But we are aspiring to become physicians, and we understand the issue of patient care and what's best for patients. So we do sympathize with the position Larkin has taken in that they want to give the best possible environment for their patients. And at this time, it would not be wise for us to start there.
Hmm. So what are you doing?
Well, as of now, we are in good standings with our university. They've been very, very supportive. Ross is a very good school. Through the adversity, throughout everything, their position has not changed with us. They said, we are behind you all the way, which is very commendable, and I really appreciate it.
How long had you been there as students?
Well, we've been here for, we've been with Ross for two calendar years, approximately.
Hmm. And so right now, will you begin a new internship at another hospital?
I think that is how it's going to come around. Where exactly, we're not sure. If it's going to be in Miami or not, we don't know. But we will continue our education, yes.
Right now, what are your thoughts about, for example, the Justice Department has talked about the TIPS program. Here in New York, the governor has announced there will be a TIPS hotline where anyone should report suspicious activity. What is your response to this?
Well, I mean, to me, I guess the intention is good, right? But as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, you know. And what does that mean exactly? Does that mean I see somebody and based on the way they look, I can pick up a phone and have them detained for 17 and a half hours handcuffed? Do you know? It's an open door. What can we say about that?
Hmm. One of the three of you wears a head covering.
That would be me.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any response similar to this? I mean, not with the press attention, but since last September 11th, how has the atmosphere been for you, for Kambiz, for Omar in this last year?
Well, as for me, I mean, it's not... I can't say that anybody was confrontational or anybody came up insulting or anything like that, but a lot of people do look, you know, and they... you can see it in their eyes, either fear or something, and it hurts a lot because we are American. And we would, if you have any questions about Muslims, go ask. You know, come and ask me. I'd be more than happy to sit down with anybody who has any questions, and I can say that about any Muslim, honestly. As to my friends, I don't know.
Omar Chowdhury.
Hi. Yeah, I think that I've noticed. People always look at you differently when you're outside of what they're used to seeing. As far as Muslims go, people who have the you know, wear the kufi and have a beard like Ayman, get most of the attention. And unfortunately, it's become because of the media and because of some people who, you know, who've done these horrible things. They associate that with being afraid of it. They're afraid of it.
In the descriptions of what happened, Cambiz Butt, it says you were not only taken out of your car, but the car was searched with robots and bomb-sniffing dogs, that there was a massive manhunt for you. 20 miles of Alligator Alley were shut down. A bomb squad blew up a backpack. Whose backpack was it?
That was Eamon's backpack, and what it contained was a nebulizer for his nephew.
What's a nebulizer?
Two-and-a-half-year-old nephew. A nebulizer is for asthma. It helps you breathe. And supposedly they thought it was some sort of dangerous item, I guess. I don't know.
How did you all go about finding an attorney? Did you have attorneys before?
No, actually, we didn't have attorneys before. What happened was we arrived to Miami, and some people contacted us and said that, you know, you would have to seek legal counsel because of the situation you're placed in. So CARE actually contacted us, which is a consul in American Islamic Relations, and they've been so, you know, so supportive throughout all of this. They covered our case pro bono. They set up a team of lawyers, which have been excellent, and they pretty much took our case and got us through this whole ordeal.
Will you be taking any legal action?
No, we will not. We won't be taking any legal action because we really don't have any intent to do so. All we want to do is continue our careers. We have nothing against Mrs. Stone. We have nothing against the Georgia police, and we have nothing against the FBI. They were doing their jobs. They went ahead on a tip. Unfortunately, the story was based on false. You know, but we have no grudge against any of those people.
Ayman Gaith, how will this incident affect you, your work as a doctor, your life here in America now?
Well, actually, since all this media coverage and interviews, we've had people come up to us and give us warm words, and it really makes a whole lot of difference. Before, people would look at you and they'd have these assumptions, and now hopefully after seeing us on TV, they can see that Muslims, what they associate with Muslims and Islam is so not the mainstream of Islam. You know, this is like less than 1% of Muslims. Actually, Islam is a religion of peace, and I hope this event has helped to open some people's eyes to that.
Amidst all the emails that you got, many of them extremely threatening, that the school and the hospital got, were there emails or letters or calls of support?
Well, actually, the predominant majority of the emails were of supportive nature. We had even people calling to pledge money for our legal defense, and it was great. The support that has come to us from all over the nation is overwhelming, and it's very humbling, actually, for private persons such as ourselves to be placed in this situation and see that there are so many people out there with a good heart and with conscious minds. And we urge people to continually call your senators, call your congressmen. We need change in this issue because it happened to us now, and it was a good situation for us. But it happens all the time, and it happens everywhere. And we really need your help, you know, to combat against this kind of action.
What kind of doctors are you each going to be?
I hopefully will try to get into emergency care medicine, and Cambiz wants to do cardiology. And Umar wants to do radiation oncology, hopefully.
Ayman Gaith, Cambiz Butt, Umar Chowdhury, three medical students who were driving through Florida and were stopped by federal authorities based on a woman who said she heard them speaking about 911 in a Georgia restaurant. Again, the latest news, authorities in Florida have admitted they made a mistake in arresting the three young men on suspicion of planning an attack. They have now begun a new internship in Florida. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, an update on a case we were reporting on last week from Houston, Texas, about a family of 11 who are being deported, a Palestinian family. The deportation was stopped, but now it looks like the INS is moving in once again. Then we'll speak with activists from South Africa and Fiji who have come to the United States to participate in the mass mobilization against the IMF and World Bank that's taking place next weekend in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Naima, John Coltrane. He would have been 76 years old today. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm looking at a Houston Chronicle piece from Saturday. It says, just when a Palestinian family here began to hope they could stay in this country, they learned late Friday that a congressional bill introduced on their behalf had been killed. The Kespes, a family of nine residing in West Houston, now could face deportation to Jordan as soon as Tuesday. Family members said the news Friday evening was particularly bitter because they'd been led to believe earlier in the day they might win their case. It quotes Noor Kespa, who's 19, saying it's like a seesaw. One day you're up, the next day you're down. The family, she said, will attempt to organize a national protest among Arabs and Muslims to push for their cause until the last minute. The family had planned to leave the country Friday, but Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat from Houston, introduced a special bill in Congress that would have allowed the Kespes to stay here permanently, even though eight of them are illegal immigrants. But after raising hopes, Jackson Lee called the family late Friday to say the bill had been killed by a Republican she would not name. We're joined right now by Noor Kespa, 19 years old, from Houston. Welcome again to Democracy Now! Well, I thought that our conversation on Friday was it. You had just said that you'd been told that the deportation had been put off. So what happened?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to go into the details of what exactly happened, but a Republican sabotaged the bill. It was before it was introduced because Senator Kennedy sent a letter, and while it was passed on in the House, was stopped by a Republican who said that you can't transfer a bill from the House to the Senate, which means, which leads me to my point, is that we need a senator to sponsor the same bill that Mrs. Lee came up with. We need a senator. So I need everyone who has a conscience, everyone who cares about this family, to pick up the phone or, you know, email their senators, tell them to sponsor this bill so that this family can stay. And this will benefit about 300,000 other people because we were kicked out of Palestine, out of Saudi Arabia, and now we're being kicked out of a model nation, the United States of America. And we're not giving up. And we have about 20 organizations behind us, and we have a lot of people behind us. And we are very optimistic. Actually, 50% of the job has been done already. You know, the other 50% is on up to people, whether they want to call their senators or not. We are not going to give up, and my family should serve as an example of reevaluating our immigration policies because even though we're Palestinians, we're no different than any other American.
Do you know who the Republican was who has killed this bill?
It was a Republican, but Mrs. Lee is the only one who knows who he is, and she did not release his name or any other information. So I'm going to stop like right there.
And how is your mother doing? When we spoke to you, she was just undergoing an operation. When the deportation was originally put forward, she was going to stay until she recuperated. But then you had gotten the news that you all would not be deported. Now, again, the deportation is set for tomorrow?
You know, this is like a battle. This is like a soccer game. Now the ball is in their goal. See, what happened was, I mean, they wanted to appeal the deportation as soon as possible because our passports expire on the 27th. They want to make sure we get out of this country before the 27th deadline. And also on the 29th, they can be sued because that would be the six-month mark. And our lawyer will file for habeas corpus for detaining a man for 6 months when they know that his travel documents are expired and are not going to be renewed anytime soon. But my mom, she was released yesterday, and INS want the whole family to appear on Wednesday. They moved it up one day, Wednesday. They want the whole family to appear, including my mother, who can't even walk. She's laying in bed right now. She can hardly talk. This is ridiculous. And we have a lot of people backing us up. Today we're going to go to the federal court, downtown Houston. Our lawyer's filing habeas corpus right now. We're going to have a press conference. Like I said, 20 organizations are backing us up right now. They're going to be there protesting this whole thing.
And the business that your family has run, you've been here for 11 years, the flag distribution company, after 9/11 giving out a lot of American flags, what's happened to it?
Yeah, this is very ironic. We were, you know, Palestinians, Muslims, selling the American flag. We donating it to churches and to synagogues. The Holocaust Museum, we donated about 50 flags to the Holocaust Museum just the other day. And we invested all of our money from Saudi Arabia in this business. And if we're sent to Jordan, we're destroyed, basically. Especially the 9-year-old sister, my sister, who is an American citizen. She does not speak any Arabic. Her hopes and dreams are in this country. Her friend is having a birthday party next week. She's telling me, am I going to stay here to be able to see her birthday? I don't know how to answer her. I mean, this is really sad.
We've been speaking with Noor Kespa. She's 19. She's part of the Kespa family of nine, who the U.S. government is threatening with deportation this week. If people want to get more information, Noor, where can they go on the web or in terms of a phone number, if you have one?
Okay. Well, they can go on the Senate website, www.senate.gov, to look up their senators, or they can contact me at my 1-800-667-FLAG 3524. 1-800-667-FLAG 3524.
Noor Kespa, thank you for being with us. Also, this update about Mazen Al-Najjar. He's the former University of South Florida engineering instructor who was deported from the United States, from Florida. He had been jailed on secret evidence that prosecutors said linked him to terrorism, although they had never presented that evidence. He was deported several weeks ago and apparently was sent to Lebanon. But now it looks like Mazen Al-Najjar has been thrown out of Lebanon. This according to his brother-in-law, Sami Al-Aryan, who's also a professor, was a professor at the University of South Florida. He was expelled from Lebanon on Wednesday, where he'd been dropped off by U.S. immigration authorities last month. A six-month visa granted by Lebanon apparently was revoked after the Lebanese government raised concerns about the United States dumping Mazen Al-Najjar there. Najjar's family said they believed he's now either in Iran or an unspecified African country. Najjar called his sister in Beirut on Friday to tell her he was safe, but he wouldn't say where he was because he didn't want to jeopardize his situation. Professor Sami Al-Aryan in Tampa said, "I feel awful. I feel everybody is letting him down. If Lebanon didn't want him, they should not have let him in." You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by three activists from South Africa and Fiji to talk about the effects of the World Bank and the IMF in their country leading up to this weekend's protests in Washington. We'll also be joined by a spokesperson from the World Bank. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Large-scale protests are planned against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund this next weekend in Washington, D.C., Friday and Saturday. But there are a number of smaller demonstrations that are getting underway today. At 3:30 this afternoon, a protest is planned in support of local hotel and restaurant workers. The protest will be taking place in front of the Ronald Reagan International Trade Building. At 5, there's going to be another protest in front of the IMF headquarters. The demonstration will be against practices in the tobacco industry, and there will be others. Right now, we're joined by people who have come in from Fiji and South Africa to talk about why they're headed to Washington, D.C. We're going to start with Mwenke Mayakiso, who's president of the National Association of Residents and Civics Organizations, known as NARCO, in Johannesburg. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about why you've come halfway around the world for these protests?
Actually, I wanted to share our experiences in South Africa on how the policies that are being implemented in our countries and that are actually emphasized by the World Bank and IMF are affecting us in South Africa. So I wanted to share that with other people in America.
How are the World Bank and IMF affecting South Africa?
Actually, the policies that are affecting us actually are those that are like privatization of public social services like water, electricity, education. And these policies are affecting us negatively, as now we are finding ourselves, the majority of people, losing jobs because the government has just implemented the is in the process of implementing these policies that are emphasizing privatization.
Why is Thabo Mbeki doing this, the president of South Africa? He was a well-known, fierce fighter against apartheid.
I think maybe through the conduct he have with people from IMF and World Bank, they believe that by doing so, the economy of the country will grow. And through our experiences that there is no economy that can grow through privatization. The only problem we are going to encounter is that people will lose jobs and health services will go down. The poor people will suffer most. So maybe Comrade Thabo is convinced that this will help actually to develop the country.
Shelley Rao is also with us, coordinator of the Economic and Social Justice Program at the Ecumenical Center for Research Education Advocacy in Suva, Fiji. What about the policies of the World Bank and IMF in Fiji?
The policies of international financial institutions like IMF, World Bank, and also agencies like the World Trade Organization and the Asian Development Bank has a direct impact on the people of Fiji and also the country and the environment, in that in Fiji we are experiencing, sorry, not just Fiji, but in the Pacific, there is very serious concern for climate change. And there's an island in the Pacific that's called Tuvalu, and in the next decade or two, that island could be completely underwater if the sea levels are rising at the rate it is now. But we also experience coral bleaching, which has serious consequences for our ecosystem, our marine system. And also, the rising sea levels has implications for the freshwater supply in our countries.
Mm-hmm. And what does that have to do with the World Bank?
Well, the policies that are being promoted by the World Bank, actually the whole neoliberal agenda, and the fact that the industrialized countries are not being made to realize the importance of signing conventions like the Kyoto Protocol that the U.S. and in Australia refuse to sign to this date, and what that means for countries like us. The policies of the World Bank and IMF, and also promoting foreign investment, the whole trade liberalization, investment liberalization, and what that means in terms of our countries, our small producers, and in competition with the multinational corporations.
Eric Chinje is also with us. He is a senior communications officer at the World Bank and vice chair of the World Bank IMF Africa Club. Could you respond to some of the concerns that have been voiced so far?
Yes, thank you, Amy. I've been listening very closely to what my friends are saying from South Africa and the Fiji. Clearly, it's my reaction is, well, you know, you can kill a dog and give it a bad name. It's hard to understand that a respected African leader like Thabo Mbeki would, who's done so much for his country, and who's leading one of the, what we consider, and most people around the world would agree, one of the most, has a very, you know, very good economic policy, would be accused of caving into pressures from the World Bank or the IMF. I mean, Mr. Mbeki has not caved in to the, you know, to the demands to borrow from the from the bank or the IMF, which he isn't doing. South Africa is not in a lending mode with the bank. And obviously is has demonstrated that this is a country that will go its own way when it needs to, and will apply policies that make the most sense for that country. So if the problem is with the privatization of public services, obviously because South Africa cannot, the South African government is not in a position to generate enough resources to maintain those services. But then, you know, if a target has to be found and it cannot be the South African government or the government in Fiji, then obviously the bank and the fund, along with the other international organizations, as our guest from Fiji said, the WTO and the ADB, you know, should be blamed. And I suppose that's what's happening here.
Sarah Mutembo is also with us from South Africa. She, too, an activist against the World Bank and the IMF, also a longtime anti-apartheid activist. Your response to Mr. Chinje? Your response to the idea that Thabo Mbeki would not be doing something that was detrimental for South Africa. Let me ask that question to Ms. Wenke Mayakiso.
My response will be in this form. The person who just spoken actually believe that, doesn't believe that Comrade Thabo can apply such policies. But what I'm talking about here, I'm talking about our own experience on the ground. This is what we are feeling as people who are on the ground, that privatization is not going to help us, as we have experienced people losing jobs. Services are getting expensive. As the majority of people of South Africa are unemployed, we are finding it difficult, I mean, to meet, I mean, the... to pay for the services if then now they are going to be privatized in this fashion.
Eric Chinjay, what about this issue of privatization of basic services like water?
Well, I mean, the government has to find money. If the government has to maintain and sustain these services, it has to find the money from somewhere, and that would have to come from the taxes it gets, and it would have to expand that tax base. But how do you expand a tax base in an economy that is stagnating, or it's not expanding at the pace at which, the population is expanding? So clearly, the government has a problem. It's has to find a solution, to maintain these services, to continue to try to create jobs, which I don't hear my friend addressing. The government has to continue to create jobs. This has to, mean new investments in new areas of production. The government, has to find the money to do that or open up to a private enterprise, which is where jobs are created, which is where new technologies are brought into the production cycle.
Are you concerned when you privatize water, what happens when people cannot afford water to drink?
I do not think the problem here is privatization per se. I think the problem has to do with ensuring that people have access, more people have access to potable water. That is the issue. And we have to find a way of increasing the number of people. In South Africa, for example, over 80% of the population at one point, by the end of apartheid, most of the population did not have access to potable water. So there's a serious problem in the country. Resources are limited. The government has to find a way of ensuring that, most people have such access. And how does it do it in a climate of limited resources, in an environment where resources are limited? I don't know what my friend has offers in terms of a solution. I do not think that President Thabo Mbeki or anybody else would want to would suggest that we try to get money from or get people who cannot afford it to pay for water. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I think it is more about getting water to people and making sure that they can afford it.
Let me bring Shelley Rao into the... You want to respond to that?
Yes.
Wanky Mikey, so if not...
You talk about jobs that are created, of which the jobs that are created actually are of poor quality, as they don't help, the people, because there is not a lot of people getting employment. The only jobs that we are finding are those that maybe one will work for 6 months without being registered on contract basis. Then after that 6 months, you find that the contract can be terminated at any time if the employer feels like. And the jobs that are coming are those that are not labor intensive, of which they are of poor quality to the poor people of South Africa. The only people we witness is that many people will lose their jobs, and those people who have, means to create these jobs are the ones who are benefiting. The rich are getting richer, whereas the poor are getting poorer.
Let me bring Shelley Rao back into the conversation. Your response on the issue.
That's a typical response to from an institution like the IMF or the World Bank about finding a target and trying to shoot the target. And I think that's where the concern is. Our concern is the policies, the neoliberal agenda that has been promoted by these institutions. Now, of course, we admit and we recognize and acknowledge that our governments or our cronies, our elitists are involved in it as well. And why? Because they have been molded, they're taught, they're educated in the system, and so they become part of the system. Now, whether Thabo Mbeki or Ngarase from Fiji borrows from the World Bank or not is not the issue. We're part of this global agenda, and so if we want to do something, for instance, Asian Development Bank is probably like the sister organization of the World Bank in the Pacific. And so while we approach the Asian Development Bank to borrow money, we are being forced or under pressure to comply with IMF World Bank policies there. Similarly, we are being under pressured to comply with World Trade Organization. And in fact, in the Pacific, if you see now, we're in the process of implementing a Pacific Free Trade Agreement. And that is the stepping stone to the Pacific region complying with WTO standards.
I wanted to bring Sarah Matembu into the conversation, also with the South African organization, National Association of Residents and Civics Organizations. What you think is the most effective way of organizing as an anti-apartheid organizer yourself?
I can start with, when I came here, I just came and share my ideas. How did we defeat the old regime? I mean, the old government of South Africa. But when I hear people speaking here, I'm concerned because of really in South Africa, we are suffering. People like me, I suffer a lot. Even today, I haven't got a job. I got children, I got grandchildren. Nobody is working in the house. And my house, it was burned down. And my children had been killed in 1986. Even today, no one came to my place to say anything. No one, they just take me like somebody doesn't know. It's my concern, that one. What is the government doing? What is the people saying? No one comes to my place. No one just want to know about me. Since it was unbanned, this organization, I vote for the organization, and it's my organization. But why? Why it's like this?
You live in Alexandria
I'm
Township.
I'm living in Alexander. Yes.
What is your What are your thoughts on this, Mzwanki Mayakiso?
Actually, I think by coming and share our experiences with other comrades in the U.S., we are trying to show them that there is no much difference from what we experienced in the apartheid regime than now, because we still suffer. We saw these neoliberal policies actually pushing for these policies that are very unkind to people. So we urge international communities to come and help us, form ties with us, form alliances, and try to close these big institutions that are exploiting our countries and the poor of the poorest.
Shelley Rao.
I wanted to make a very quick comment about privatization, and the spokesperson of the World Bank is right in that he said that the objective was to ensure that people have access, or more people have access. And I find it very hard to believe that that would happen when you allow transnational corporations or multinational corporations to come into a country to provide the service, when we know full and well that their ultimate motive is to make money. And initially, when they come into a country, that the services may be provided at a comparable rate, but afterwards our experience is that the rate increases. And so I don't see people having access to these services.
We only have a few seconds. Eric Chinje of the World Bank, your response.
Yeah, well, it clearly seems to me that there is need for some civil dialogue between the various parties, because obviously nobody has the solution to the many problems.
Are you prepared for these protests this weekend in Washington?
Well, we continue to hope that there would be a platform, a forum, where we can discuss these ideas. And I think that's where we should be going, because clearly nobody, as I say again, not the World Bank, not the not the donors, the governments that support us, have the answers. So we need to sit down and talk.
On that note, I want to thank you all for being with us, Eric Chinje, Shelley Rao, Sarah Matembu, and Mzwanki Mayakiso. And that does it for today's program. You can go to our website for contact information at www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org, and you can call for a cassette of today's program at 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, and Angie Karen. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer and music maestro, sitting in for Anthony Sloan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.